the She Leads podcast. This episode is brought to you by the She Leads Podcast Network. It's the podcast network for women by women. What follows is an episode that is very special to me, and we reserved it specifically for Women's History Month. You see, at the end of 2023, we held the She Leads Live 2023 conference. It is an annual conference that takes place every year in New York City. And each year we kick off the conference with a VIP evening the night beforehand for those who want to network, to hear from an expert speaker, and to really get to know each other well before they attend the conference the next day. So in 2023, we were fortunate enough to hold the VIP evening at a luxury penthouse apartment atop the New York City skyline. This particular property was staged for sale by IMG Interior Marketing Group and led by the masterful and creative CEO, Cheryl Eisen. Cheryl's work has been featured in Architectural Digest, Elle Decor, Forbes, Wall Street Journal, The Robb Report, and on TV, Bravo TV, Open House TV, NBC, CBS, Fox, and more. Cheryl is an embodiment of the characteristics that make up an entrepreneur. She's innovative. She seeks opportunity. She's growth-minded. And things haven't always been smooth sailing for Cheryl, even though to take a look at her, you would think that it's all glamour. Well, it's not. And just like on the rest of the She Leads podcast episodes, we pull back the curtain to talk about what's real without any sugar coating. So in this particular episode, you will hear a conversation between our strategic partner and accomplished journalist Tanya Klitsch, who hails from prestigious publications like Forbes and Marie Claire. Tanya's also an adjunct professor of journalism at NYU. So this conversation that takes place between Tanya and Cheryl is both insightful and downright inspirational. This was a really beautiful evening. There were about 60 or 70 people in attendance, and we all gathered round to hear the conversation, fireside chat between Tanya and Cheryl, and we captured all of it. So listen in and be inspired with the following conversation that took place at our VIP evening. I'm the CEO of She Leads Media, and
hello, I'm Tori Barker. I'm the CMO for She Leads Media.
And we are just beyond, I think, grateful and overwhelmed by everybody that is here. This night is made possible by Cheryl Eisen, who is a beautiful human being. I'm going to cry. Cheryl has been a friend of She Leads Media for several years prior to COVID, during COVID, after COVID, and we are all here tonight because of Cheryl and her team. So let's please give a round of applause to Cheryl. I just want to say very quickly, Tanya is going to dive deep into Cheryl's background, but I just want to say that Cheryl really, you know, walks the talk. She is a humongous supporter of women entrepreneurs. And I think that this is testament to it. And I just could not be more grateful. And I know that Tori and I are just overwhelmed with emotion for all of you that came out here tonight. So this is a very, very special evening. We are going to witness a podcast between Tanya Klitsch, who's the senior editor for Money and Career at Marie Claire magazine. She's incredible and has everybody's incredible. Tanya has been a friend of She Leads Media for such a long time as well. And she's a dynamo, brilliant. And so you will get to listen in to this incredible conversation between Tanya and Cheryl. And then after, we'll open it up for some questions so that we can truly have a fireside conversation. So would you like to say
Sure.
Just again, thank you guys so much for being here. And we're excited for you to listen into this exclusive podcast.
Take it away, Tanya.
Awesome. Okay, everyone, all the questions are in here, okay? I'm not checking my Instagram. They're all here. And I'm going to ask very intentional questions because I know everyone here came from different places across the country, different industries, and different life chapters. So because of that, we really value you being here. And I know this podcast is called Sugarcoated, but of course, that means we're not going to sugarcoat anything. Cheryl is being very generous and sharing her founder's story with us here today. So, you know, first and foremost, celebrity interior designer. That just has so many meanings. Of course, you've designed for biggest names from Jeff Bezos before the Vogue shoot, right? To Kim Kardashian and Bethany Frankel, just to name a few. My goodness. But Cheryl really is a celebrity interior designer in her own right. She is a celebrity within her industry and within the female founder community because all she's done. We're going to get into the nitty-gritty of it all, but Cheryl Eisen, the CEO and founder of IMG, Interior Marketing Group, NYC. And does NYC even matter anymore? Because you have projects, I mean, Miami, LA, around
Africa.
The world. Yes, Africa, around the world. So IMG, global, yes. But can you give the audience a quick snapshot of what it is, what it does?
Interior Marketing Group is a company that does real estate marketing and interior design, which helps sell properties. Our niche is the highest end properties there are because it's a small niche and not many staging companies, if you've heard of stagers, have the inventory or even the capacity or the manpower or logistics to be able to do homes in this realm. So that's our specialty, and we have been in business for 16 years. I started out as a broker, and I got what people were responding to, so this is what we create.
Yes, so many lessons to be learned within this journey, from innovating, making the recipe your own. But first, let's start with the founder's story. I know all the snapshots of your career in luxury interior design look fabulous, but I'm sure there were not so fabulous episodes when it came to starting and launching and even finding your career within IMG. In fact, I believe that some of our successes are really rooted or stem from some of our darkest hours. So can you just tell me, how did IMG come about and how did you pivot in order to find, to get out your darkest hours within your career?
I didn't graduate high school. I think everyone knows this. And then I just worked and worked and worked as a graphic designer. When I was 24, I founded a company in the internet industry back when that was just a new thing for everyone who's my age. And it was successful for 10 years. I was riding high. And then the bubble burst and I went out of business. I had no money. And I was 35-ish. And I couldn't get a job because I didn't have a college degree. My resume was like CEO. Nobody is interested in that. And for years and years, I was unemployed. But I had a lot of time to watch TV. And I was watching HGTV. And there was a show called The Stagers. And I was like, that's really interesting. My friend was selling his apartment. I got my real estate license. And I was like, let me stage your apartment and sell it. I'll get my real estate license. And that's what I did. No one was staging 16 years ago in New York for some reason. It was a brand new industry. So it was really good timing. I was very lucky. The apartment sold immediately for a record price, all cash. And then in the building, everyone said, what is this staging? Can you stage and sell my apartment? And then the brokers at Corcoran also said, can you stage our listings? So staging them became the main focus of my thing. But it was years of huge struggle living on my mom's sofa, and it was, everyone sees the final product, which is the glamorous part, but it was years and years of really hard struggle, being completely broke, living on my mom's sofa, and being unemployed.
Yeah, and to get things going, I mean, here we are in a space you designed. I mean, this is jaw-dropping. There are no words to describe this space. It's beautiful. It's Cheryl Eisen to a T. But I'm sure in the early days, as you were beginning your staging career, It required a lot of, as you called it, MacGyvering, staying within budget in order to get things off the ground. How did you do that? What did you do?
Yeah, when no one knew what staging was, I had to basically pay for it out of my own pocket. So, and if you're selling real estate, you don't get a salary. It's all commission. So there's really no money in it. With all my savings, I would go on Craigslist and buy things. This is when Craigslist was like a really cool thing. Yeah. And I completely spruced up a place with the Craigslist stuff. I would just spend my nights searching Craigslist, great buys on there, fix up places, make them really like warm and homey. And it was like design on a dime, literally. Tape things together. It was like Band-Aids and, putting pig on a lipstick.
No, it's really interesting. We are just having a conversation now. And even though from your early days launching your career in interior design and staging to today, when you have these beautiful multi-million dollar properties, you're still taking that budget savvy entrepreneurial soul approach, because you just told me about these two pieces and I thought, oh, this must be straight from a gallery in Miami or Basel, but where did you get them?
Etsy.
The entrepreneur within never dies, right?
Well, we have a company, Art Loft, in our company that actually creates modern art, original pieces. It's a large portion of our business, but I just saw these and thought they were so cool. But yes, Etsy, you can find some great stuff.
Noted. Okay, well, let's still go back to your career as a real estate agent. It's 2005. You're a thriving real estate agent. But again, a little voice is telling, even though you found a company before, a little voice is telling you to do something a little different. Tell me more about getting the staging career off the ground, your first hires, getting the word out about yourself. As you said, many didn't do staging here in New York City. How did you gain visibility? This was before we had social media. So tell us about how to get, this is a great lesson, in organic marketing.
The hustle. Yes, guerrilla marketing, the hustle. That's right. It was before before social media. So I was selling real estate. I was not a great salesperson, I'm not going to lie. Mm-hmm. And thank God I was good at staging. It was helping me sell these places where I didn't have to sell anything and just open the door and here it is. And eventually, as more brokers hired me to stage their listings, that became my main focus. And there was a pivot at some point where I was doing more of that than I was getting listings. Mm-hmm. So it just made sense to like take the risk and found a company, stop selling real estate, and just focus on a staging company. And it was bootstrap, 5 years before I even hired anyone. I hired a handyman from Craigslist. It was great. He just retired this year. Mm-hmm. And he also told me that he was actually not a handyman. He just advertised. He learned on the job, but it worked. So, yeah, I mean, it was a risk. It was scary. There was no safety net underneath. But I worked nonstop so hard. I would send out emails to all the brokers, probably one by one, because, I didn't buy a list. I would be pounding the pavement, making calls, going to open houses, trying to get the word out. I stage, this is a stage. My biggest, I think, initial wow sale thing moment was when Frederick Eklund, this is back in the day, if anyone knows who he is, he's from Million Dollar Listing. He was not always famous. He was just another broker, and he had some listing. And he finally, I finally, after calling and calling and saying, hire me, I'm a stager, I would go online and look at empty listings, if you've ever seen empty listings, and I would call those brokers and say, let me stage this place, I can help you sell it. And he finally hired me to stage one of his places.
Paint a picture of that first place for Frederick Eklund, just to show how far you've come.
It's really cool. He had a listing that was empty for a year, wasn't selling, and that's really the story that, for all the brokers that I finally got to stage for. He said, what is the staging? And I said, let me meet you on the site. I went to the site. It was a really cool duplex, but it wasn't staged. So I said, let me stage this place. I'm going to tell a story. This is going to be like a James Bond vibe. And that's what we're going to do. Like, I'm going to do like a white fur carpet and like, martini glasses. So he was like, all right, I'm going to give you a shot. I staged it. It was really fun, really cool. Very James Bond. 10 days later, he calls me on the phone and says, You're never going to guess who bought this apartment 10 days later. Daniel Craig.
Meant to be. Meant to be. Amazing.
And then from there on out, you know, he was my client. And then he was spreading the word. And then he got a TV show and brought me on that. And, yeah. You know, it's all about the relationships you make. And
yeah, so you got your breakthrough idea, your breakthrough collaboration, and your breakthrough client. Tell me how this all led to your multi-platform approach to design, selling homes, etc.
Before social media, there was email marketing, and it wasn't saturated like it is now. So, like, you could actually send a constant contact email. You could measure the results. Every day I was looking, who opened it? They opened it 4 times. But you do whatever you can. So I was sending emails and making phone calls. And that, when I got a listing and I staged it, I would also send out emails saying, this is our staged listing. So it was promotion for me initially. But at the same time, it was promoting that listing and the broker who was representing that listing. And I thought, there's value there as well. It's not just, and eventually when I got a huge following, I always knew the power of PR. And so when you're starting your business, if you can make as many PR connections as possible, mm-hmm. there's no advertising like someone reading about you in a magazine or a newspaper. So eventually I was seeking out PR. I was coming up with story ideas, pitching them. And the New York Times called and did a front page of the real estate section story called Ruthless Came the Stager. And after that, the phone just did not stop ringing. It was the pivot moment. But it's all of that promotion that you do and finding a way to make promotion work not only for your clients, but for you simultaneously. And then when social media came out, it was the same thing. I'm promoting my listings so people can see them, but at the same time, I'm promoting these listings for the brokers. So no one else was doing that, and I thought, beautiful photographs. I don't like the real estate photographs, so I hired a photographer to take beautiful editorial photographs, and the brokers benefit from that as well. So that's the multi-tiered approach to marketing.
Lots of lessons coming at me right now. Let's break it down. Okay, so first, power of PR. Let's be honest. And again, let's take off the sugar coat. A lot of women find it difficult to advocate for themselves, promote and speak up for themselves, and kind of really identify just all the unique values they bring to a project. How did you overcome that?
You have to come up with a story that's unique and story worthy. Most people have one. You have to search. If you're in a saturated industry, dig deep and find out what's unique about your story. And you can pitch headlines to PR people, but tell that story. People are buying you, right? So, you know, I had a unique story and I told it over and over to whoever would listen. And then I started calling myself like the top stager in New York. Nobody knew I was, but become sell the person that you want to become, and it will be real. I mean, you have to work your ass off as well. But yeah, the power of promoting yourself, be confident, and if you believe in yourself, people will believe in you.
Awesome. And I also see, you know, moments in time where you are outsourcing, you are investing in yourself by hiring a photographer. Tell us how the key hires or the key people that allowed you to really shine and really helped make the snowball effect happen for IMG.
Yeah, one of the hardest parts for female entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs is scaling. When do you scale? How do you scale? How do you pay for another employee? It's very scary to be responsible for the first employee's salary in their life. It's very intimidating. So I waited a really long time until it was physically painful for me to do it myself. First hire was another person who could do what I do and go out there and do the hard part. And I kept doing the marketing. And, you know, so you have to figure out who your first hire is going to be. Replace yourself in ways that you can while you're the only person who can sort of run the company. So I started by hiring a stager. That was like the first person. Now I could do 2 stagings at a time. And then I can grow the company slowly that way. But go ahead.
And how many employees today?
100.
Oh, just 100. No big deal. Amazing. Yeah. So tell us more about
rules with hiring and firing. And I'm going straight to firing because that's also part of making sure that your company's protected and set up for success. Tell us about it.
When you first start hiring, you will almost hire anyone that wants to work for you. It's like, you'll work for me? Thanks. Come on. But then you realize, you know, if it's not going to work out, the firing is really, nobody loves firing people, but it is something that you have to do. You have to take emotion out of it and do it for the success of your company and the lifeline of your company. So firing is really hard. I always cried in the firings more than the person I was firing. But, you know, it's something that I realized I had to do to, you know, you have to weed out things to make the company strong and grow. And that's the hiring, firing part.
Yeah. And before you started IMG, you mentioned you started another company. Can you tell us about that and how that also played a role in your past experiences, played a role and influenced how you lead IMG today?
That's the other thing. Before I started my company, I did a million different jobs. And every job that I did, I was a graphic designer. So I know marketing. I know how to do a computer marketing thing. I know the computers. I was a headhunter. I know how to hire people. I know how to poach people. I know how to find them. I know how to interview. And so take everything from your experience that you've learned in regular, you know, business and jobs and apply that to running your business. It came in so handy to be able to do those things.
Yeah. You know, we come from workplace culture where it almost stigmatizes the idea of job hopping or not staying within your lane, but it actually might be a good thing, as you proved.
Try tons of things, right? Learn as much as you can out there so that you can take those skills to your business as an entrepreneur.
Awesome. You rose above, you know, the difficult time in your 20s when you were trying to find your career within real estate. And you rose above, you know, your past ventures that closed you. But I'm sure, as we are discussing, career success, it's not linear and it's a zigzag. It's cyclical. It's all over the place, right? So you rose above the past, and of course, while running IMG, as it grew, as it scaled, I'm sure you still ran into all the drama. Tell me about a dark chapter in IMG's history and how you navigated through it.
You know, when you're running a business and you're responsible for a ton of people's livelihood, it's terrifying to think that the phone could stop ringing at any time, and it does. There are days and weeks where it's like, am I going to get any business? Am I going to have to lay people off? Is it going to get... And I will get theory on this. But when COVID hit, nobody knew what was going to happen. Sorry. I had to call all of my employees on a Zoom and tell them we had to lay everyone off. And it was like, I couldn't even talk. It was the hardest thing I ever had to do. But I promised that when things came back, if they came back, when nobody knew it was going to happen, I would hire everyone back. And I did. And they all came back.
Thank you for sharing that moment. Let's, if you don't mind, continue to just dig a little deeper. Just tell us about, first, how did you deliver a difficult message? Because even I think that's maybe the true test of true leadership is leading and being honest during the downtime. So can you tell us about that? But of course, I will then ask the good stuff. So we'll get to it.
The hard stuff's really important to making it, you know, to running a company. It's never easy being a CEO, being running a company and finding your way. I don't have a Harvard MBA. I'm just figuring it out as I go along. And there are really difficult times where you're not profitable. What do you do? Like, can you try to keep everyone employed? And, you know, you have, and the stress will make you also like sort of aggressive, and then people hate you. And, you know, there's like the whole constant thing, but, you know, you have to navigate around it and figure it out. But again, like the hardest thing I'd rather do is firing is the hardest thing, in my opinion. Laying people off is the hardest thing.
Yeah. Now let's fast forward to the grand reopening of IMG. Just to give us a behind the scenes.
Slowly, we were able to hire our team back slowly as things picked up again. And that was really special. And I think people were really grateful and that felt really good. Like we all sort of came together as a team and like took care of each other and looked out for each other. It was actually a very interesting moment in business when you all go through something that scary. and it's so new and uncharted territory that I think it really made my company closer as like a family. And that was really amazing. And I think today the corporate culture in my company is very much like that.
Yeah, tell me more about the corporate culture, because now I'm sure you found a little your footing again. Post-pandemic, are you being more intentional and redesigning, no pun intended, the culture within IMG?
Before COVID, I was like flying high. We were like rapid growth. It was like expansion, expansion. And then post-COVID, I just wanted to crawl out of that hole. And it took a few years. It was not just, well, it was great. It really took years to crawl out of that hole, and we're there. I think the culture understands the hustle that has to happen. The people that I hire, they're always sort of like a similar vibe to yourself, and that's how you would hire. These are entrepreneurial, like kick-ass, like workaholics who love and are passionate about what they do. And that's how we think about our culture. And if you're not passionate about it, or if they're not, you know, they're not part of our team. It's like you can't have people that aren't loving coming to work every morning and loving what they do. So a corporate culture evolves in that way, but it is a reflection of the president, the leader of the company, because you are sort of hiring people with your same passion and vision.
Yeah. You talked about different careers you had in the past, different skills you that were largely self-taught. As you mentioned, you don't have a college degree, you don't have an MBA, and you really made the recipe your own. Tell us about what it took to basically move from marketing, and now you're moving into tangible products. What's that like? And can you tell us about it?
Doing staging, there were always things that I just couldn't find to buy that I absolutely needed. Giant pieces of art. So I started by painting them myself. And then we hired people to paint these giant pieces of art. That became a product, and we call it Art Loft. People want to buy that product. And then there were, like, giant coffee tables I couldn't find anywhere. We started making them. Dining chairs that were comfortable and really cool looking, we couldn't find them. We started making them. And you're sitting on one of our sofas right now. And those chairs over there with the boucle, those are our dining chairs that we designed. I found a purchasing person who had relationships overseas and had relationships with people who can, you know, make furniture, make bedding, and it's so much less expensive than buying retail. So it was a big part of the business to launch a product. I found out it's harder to sell it and have logistics deliver things that are big. So now we're just doing it for our own stuff. But people buy these homes furnished. And so that's how our product sells.
Yeah. What's the top skill you did have to learn when making that shift from a service to a product?
Well, we're still service, but the product part, you know, you kind of assume, hey, I'm good at whatever I'm doing. Like, I'll probably be good at that too, but it's not always the case. And it's all a learning thing. And so we learned that you can't ship big pieces, because what if someone wants to return them? That's a whole industry in and of itself. Mm-hmm. The mistakes are what teaches you. And and we're learning what does work, selling them in the space. But yeah, all of the lessons and you're shaping the way you create your company are learned from mistakes.
Understood. Before we get to audience Q&A, I just want to ask a few questions, because you have such an amazing roster of clients. Can you just tell us maybe the most interesting project you've taken on, the type of aesthetic and how you brought in your signature look to it?
Recently, we staged the most expensive penthouse in the world, I think. They just lowered the price though, so I don't know now. It was $250 million, but to have the opportunity to, they could have hired anyone, and that they hired my firm was really like amazing. But to furnish and stage and design a $250 million property with only a few billionaires are able to even afford that, what would they like? How do I do it affordably? Because the budget wasn't huge. It was amazing to bring the team together, figure it out. Budget-wise, you know, you mix in some highs and lows and, original art pieces, and we made a really amazing, amazing space.
Yes, so truly living a dream career. You've come such a long way from the days of calling up the New York Times, pitching yourself, and the constant contact emails, dialing the Frederick Eklunds of the world. Now we have social media, we have PR blasts. What are your tips for gaining visibility in a world where there is already so much noise, especially for an aspiring entrepreneur or a fledgling brand?
Yeah, and especially now that it's so noisy, it is challenging. But figure out your unique selling proposition. What's unique about you? Figure out your marketing strategy. What are you going to say? What do you have to say? And what's the messaging you're going to do? Blast it on social media, but make it like interesting and be smart about it. Take classes about how to promote yourself. I would always say this. You can have a mediocre product. You can have a fantastic product. If the fantastic product has shitty marketing, it's not going to be successful. If the mediocre, even the meh product has amazing marketing, it will succeed. It's not that it's smoke and mirrors, but it's really how you market your company. I mean, it's all about that. The branding, the packaging, the messaging. It's the most important part of having a business.
I would love to open up to audience now. I know they're all still processing all the wisdom, right? Yes.
Cheryl, you seem like such a soft, feminine person. How do you maintain that part of your personality and having such a powerful role where I'm sure you have to be different depending on who you're interacting with?
I have some of my employees right over here who are laughing. I have a soft voice, but I have such high expectations of my employees, and I don't sugarcoat things. So when I have super high expectations of people, I just say it, and it's like it's raw and it's whatever. And some people have like written on Glassdoor, like "what a bitch," blah blah blah, da da da, and it really hurts. But I'm just trying to run a company and do my thing, and I love that people see me as soft. I love that.
They might not see it.
My question has to do with culture of your business and how you monitor that and how you pivot and change things. What are some of the things that you would say are most important about the culture and how you assess that throughout the change?
I would say, again, the people that you hire, when you first start a company, again, like I just hired anyone that would work for me. I was like in awe. But as you grow the company, you know, you need to choose people who will help you be successful. They have to love your vision, share the vision, and work their asses off. Working my ass off was probably what made me successful. You know, I was a decent designer, but that was it. So the culture of people who really love to work hard and, you know, aren't complainers, they're not 9-to-5ers, they, you know, they feel entrepreneurial themselves. If you have people like that, you will succeed.
Hi, thank you so much. So how do you handle difficult employees? Can you give an example?
Difficult employees. Difficult employees. There was a while where I had like this group of stagers who hated me. And it felt like high school all over again, where I was like hiding in the bathrooms. I hated coming to work, you know, because I wasn't soft or whatever. They hated me. And that was really difficult. This was my team and they were against me. Slowly but surely, you have to either try to win them over, which is really difficult, or let them go and replace them with people that are fresh and new and, you know, will love coming to work every day. Toxic people become a cancer in your company and it spreads. So you have to pluck them out early enough before it's like really damaging. So I would say that's the answer.
Hi, really love your story. Just curious, since we all, this is She Leads, right, about women entrepreneurship. Are there any challenges that you felt were unique as a woman, or have you felt that things really have been open to you as a woman and as an entrepreneur?
I would say trying to talk to a bank to try to get like any funding or loans, even once the company was really successful. So very few will take women seriously, especially women without a Harvard MBA and a history of success. So, but what was great about that as a woman is that I had to figure it out myself. It's self-funded, this company, which is amazing to be. You don't owe anyone anything. You're not in debt. And you run a company and grow a company on its own financials and its own merits, and it makes you smart and scrappy. So that's the challenge I think women entrepreneurs will face, because I think there's only 2% of entrepreneurs who actually, women entrepreneurs who get funded, some insane number
It's a statistic that has haunted my entire journalistic career. It's barely budged. It hasn't really budged since it's been recorded. So, but of course, being self-funded really affects your self-funding can affect your self-identity for sure.
Well, I mean, you, again, being scrappy. Yeah. I didn't have like a decent salary until a few years ago. I mean, I was living very modestly. And I think people misinterpret being a female entrepreneur and having some level of success. You're not raking in the dough. You're not making your own hours. You're working really hard and making sure everyone is paid well and that you can save enough money to keep that company going on a hard month or two. But once you start to get into a groove and you know how to be scrappy and smart with your money and smart with, you figure out how to self-fund a company to grow, you can do that with yourself. And it's like, it's everything. It makes you stronger than other companies, my competitors who are in debt, and I know they're struggling. It's very empowering to feel that I can do it myself.
Wonderful question, man. Thanks so much for sharing the story. It's so inspiring. If you were to pinpoint like three qualities that you think have kind of given you that entrepreneurial spirit, three qualities that helped you succeed as an entrepreneur, what would they be?
Work ethic. That's probably all three of them. I never stopped working. I love it. I took 10 years off of dating to just focus on my company. And my company soared during that time. And it was like the happiest 10 years of my life. But really, just incredible focus, incredible work ethic. Like I just work nonstop. And then stuff started falling into place. Some guy called me. I met some guy and blah, blah, blah. And my company was in a place where I didn't have to just obsess over it. So one, work ethic. Two, passion. You have to love what you do. You have to love it. Because there are hard times. And to wake up in the morning and be like, I'm dying to go to work. I got to fix this. I've got to make this work. So that's number two. And number three, you have to be tough. And that was something that, as a soft person, that I did have to, you know, get a little bit of a callus because there are hard moments and you have to pull up your big boy pants and big girl pants and like face the stuff. So those are the three things, I think.
So you may have answered it with the last question, but I want to ask it anyway. Did your success have anything to do with a power of manifestation that you had in your life? Is it something that you truly would happen to you? Because a lot of women nowadays, I feel that there's this whole thing about manifestation. So I just want you to address if it's something that's part of that, or it's really just pure out of your hard work.
Yeah. Right. It's so interesting. I just learned about manifestation recently. I'm trying to manifest an exit. That's next. But no, it was just, I didn't even know what manifestation was, but I read so much about it recently and it's all over Instagram and I'm like, I'm trying it out. I think there's something really to it.
Like positive power of positive thinking.
Yeah.
Let's talk about exiting before we get to the next question. You mentioned the 2% statistic, and as a result of that, I think so many female founders are just so focused on the next step, but you having had experienced the whole, you know, expansion of your company into what it is today. What advice do you have for female founders when it comes to the long-term plan, the exit, et cetera?
When you start a company, always have an exit strategy. Figure out how many years that could take or what number it's going to be or how to make yourself an acquisition target, because the exit is everything. Otherwise, the business becomes an albatross and you can never get rid of it. And you can't close it down, trust me. That's just not an option. Selling your business or going public or whatever that next thing is really important to being a successful entrepreneur, and you'll find the next thing. But agreed, men, when they start businesses, always have an exit strategy in mind. No one wants to like pass it down generation to generation. I mean, it's hard because your kids, you don't know if they're going to love what you love. So always have an exit strategy.
Hi. As a therapist and a mental health consultant, something that I'm often thinking about and hearing about from the client perspective or the patient perspective is the difficulty in workplaces kind of integrating space to just be a human and a person who has mental health struggles. And in this work culture, where you mentioned you have to be tough, there's work ethic, and there's a lot of hustling. How do you, as a founder and a leader, incorporate the mental health lens on stuff? I'm always interested in thinking leaders' brain on this too.
Yeah. That is interesting. Most of my employees are women. Most of my managers are women. We're emotional beings, and I celebrate it. I'm getting teary again. Sorry. There it is. But I allow space for that. And, you know, it's sometimes I butt heads with my managers or whatever, but I allow that to happen. I allow the conflict and the resolution and the emotions in it. Like, you have to allow for that. Sometimes I'll, you know, be hard on someone, and then like hours later, I'll call and apologize. I don't know if that's the right thing to do or not, you know? But I mean, we're all human, and we have to, you know, be human at the office and make, you know, it's not that much different than a relationship, I find. So, you know, people have flaws, they have emotions, they have bad days. I allow for that.
Thank you, Cheryl, for having us here. You have mentioned work ethics. And I am also looking from the mental health industry and work with executives on the big burnout. So how do you kind of prevent that or work on your mental wellness so that with work ethics, you don't run into burnout wall?
Yeah, some burnout is a real thing. Routine saved me personally. I would go to SoulCycle every single day. That was my, you know, that was my escape. It was the endorphin high that was so important. And being routinized in that way was, for me, something that really helped me through burnout. Exercise, it's so important because it's like a drug and a healthy drug, and it helps your brain. But, you know, there are hard times where you didn't sleep for a few days. There's, you know, but it's a good question.
Should we have Craigslist or SoulCycle?
I have a question.
Oh, perfect.
So many of us get into this just to do the thing, whatever it is that we are called to be in business for. And so many of us want to do that thing, and we don't want to do necessarily the back end of the business. So my question is sort of about scale. As you continue to grow, how close are you still to doing the staging, to showing up and being artistic or creative or investing in yourself in that way, versus how much of that have you had to let go as your business has grown and evolved beyond those scrappy early days?
That's a great question. At some point when you scale your business or you grow your business, I'm no longer a stager, I'm a CEO. And there's a huge difference between the two. And one's less fun than the other, I have to say. But I make sure to get in there and oversee some of this stuff so that I still have the creative hand in it. At the same time, you know, as a CEO, you have to do it all. Marketing, finance to an extent, you know, oversight of the creative or your product. It never ends, but it definitely becomes less of a thing, unfortunately.
Thank you for sharing the story. Given how you scale, share with us, there's many challenges in getting access to capital as a woman and not any business that a lot of banks find
stable. Yeah, as I said before, talking to a bank when I could have grown I had to grow it super slowly because I had to grow the company on its own profits, because banks, I learned it also my first business, did not take women entrepreneurs seriously. I was not able to get funding. Eventually, I just gave up and just said, you know what, I got to do it myself. And again, that made my company stronger and me stronger, understanding how to work finances. But it makes you grow slower, but that might be better.
Thank you so much.
Wow, what a great conversation. I hope you took away as much from that conversation as I did. I'd love for you to be at our next VIP evening. Our She Leads Live conference is taking place in October on the 17th, 18th, and 19th. It's our 10th year anniversary, and we are so excited to be expanding our conference to over 300 people this year. So if you'd like to be in attendance at this VIP evening that is currently being planned, please purchase your tickets now. They can be found on SheLeadsMedia.com, or you can go over to the Eventbrite platform and search up She Leads Live 2024. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to Cheryl and Tanya for this engaging conversation. The She Leads Podcast Network.